Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's trip to Kenya and go to Nairobi to speak with Kefa Otiso, who is a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the US-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association. We'll discuss the country's excited anticipation of Obama's homecoming arrival on Friday, which has heightened security concerns because of recent terrorist atrocities by al-Shabaab, leading to a rebuke of CNN by Kenya's interior minister, who has demanded they apologize for calling his country a hotbed of terrorism. And before heading on to meet with Ethiopia's authoritarian regime, Obama will meet with Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta, who was up until recently facing trial at the International Criminal Court, charged with orchestrating election violence in 2007-2008 that claimed over 1,100 lives. Then we'll go to Beirut, Lebanon, and speak with a political analyst and commentator on Middle East geopolitics, Shamin Nawani. She joins us to discuss the local reaction to Secretary of State Kerry's efforts to sell the P5+1 deal with Iran to a skeptical, if not insultingly disrespectful, U.S. Senate, where the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee opened the hearings by charging that Kerry had been fleeced by the Iranians. We'll also get an update on the war next door in Syria, where Turkey appears to be taking a more forceful stance against the Islamic State. Then finally, we'll examine the consequences of a shift in Turkey's policy towards the Islamic State following a terrorist bombing of Kurdish students inside Turkey near the Syrian border and Thursday's clash on the border in which a Turkish soldier was killed by fire from Islamic State fighters inside Syria. The author of The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East, David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, joins us to argue that the decision by Turkey to allow the U.S. to use the Incirlik NATO airbase to strike the Islamic State is a game changer. And joining us from Kenya is Kefa Otiso, who's a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the US-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association and the co-author of Population Geography Problems, Concepts and Prospects, and the author of Culture and Customs of Tanzania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kefa Otiso.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
And I take it people in Kenya are quite excited about their hometown boy made good, right? President of the United States. Not bad for the son of a Kenyan citizen.
Yeah, people are very happy that he's finally coming back. Actually, he was the lead story in most of the daily newspapers here with pictures and the like. And pretty much it's looking like it's going to be a very big party.
And what about criticisms that questioning Obama's decision to meet with Uhuru Kenyatta, the country's leader, along with Ethiopia's authoritarian regime?
Well, as you might know, the U.S. is basically in a position of trying to compete with China, particularly in those two countries. And I think U.S. economic interests are taking a lead in terms of who Obama is going to meet here. And these two countries are basically gateways to both American and Chinese economic interests over here, and I really don't think that he has much of a choice in that regard.
So the fact that for a while Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta was facing the International Criminal Court, facing a trial for his alleged role in the 2007-2008 killings during the elections, that is pretty much water under the bridge, even though I take it that one of the reasons why the ICC dropped the trial was that the witnesses had disappeared. That's my understanding. What's your understanding?
Yeah, I keep hearing the same stories, but you know, the reality is that the case was dropped. It collapsed for any number of reasons, and I think that pretty much provides some sort of cover for, you know, the president to basically meet the president of Kenya. And as you know, there are other parts of the case that are ongoing. So I don't think that it necessarily undermines the pursuit of justice in regard to the matter you refer to.
Sure. But the victims in the case, as it was brought to the ICC, were largely Luo, right? The tribe in the West, which President Obama's sister and father belonged to.
No, actually, the victims were from a very broad spectrum of Kenyans, as were the perpetrators, the reported perpetrators of the crimes. So, yes, there were some Luo victims, but it was a much bigger group of victims and perpetrators.
So that's not really the issue. Then what is the issue in terms? I know that there's been some annoyance and outrage. I think the Interior Minister is complaining of CNN's coverage, describing Kenya as a hotbed of terrorism. Is that what's getting the headlines?
Yeah, that has been getting some of the headlines because, you know, what the Kenyans are saying is that if Kenya was that unsafe, maybe Obama wouldn't come. And in any case, the issue is that if the U.S. and Kenya have close cooperation in the area of security, then perhaps the kind of headlines that they are seeing from the CNN are not necessarily helpful. But at the same time, as I'm sure your listeners would know, CNN is not necessarily a spokesperson for the U.S. government. So there are a number of interests that are at stake here. And, of course, the U.S. itself has expressed some dissatisfaction with the security situation here, as indicated by the travel advisories. But at the same time, there are also a number of business interests, for example, that necessitate close cooperation between Kenya and the U.S.
So is there a palpable sense of security? Do you get the impression that there...
Oh, yeah, there is. You know, they have ended up reporting something like 10,000 policemen are going to be involved. Major streets in Nairobi have been closed. Actually, a number of people have left the capital because there isn't going to be much business. Even the airport will be closed for about an hour or so, you know, to accommodate the president. So it's very, as it is without even the president, it's a fairly inconvenient city to travel through because of major traffic jams. And when you add the U.S. president and the unique security challenges that he brings to the city, it is going to be basically gridlock. So most people, a good number of people have actually left the city just to watch it on TV.
And again, I'm speaking with Kefa Otiso, who is in Kenya. He's a professor of geography and the director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the U.S.-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association. And I think it's reasonable, though, isn't it, Kefa, to be concerned about Al-Shabaab, the Islamist militant group from neighboring Somalia. They've struck, obviously, they did that horrible massacre at the university not so long ago, and they've done carried out a number of terrorist attacks. Their presence is in the country, so it's reasonable to assume that they might try something, right?
Yeah, they might try something, but it's more likely to be on the at the fringes of the country because the capital is in the southwestern part of the country, and it's actually quite a ways from Somalia. So I wouldn't necessarily see anything threatening to the president per se, but I mean, Al-Shabaab may end up doing something in Somalia itself or even along the Kenya border because, as you know, the U.S. is involved in providing logistical support for the African force that is trying to control the Al-Shabaab. So I'm sure they're going to try and make some noise, but I don't really think it's going to be in the capital city or even anywhere close to where the U.S. president is.
So what do you think the Kenyan president is going to be asking Obama? Is there any specific thing on his agenda or on his wish list?
He did write an editorial in one of the local newspapers, and I think the old, it looks like mostly it's going to be a discussion revolving around economic development, promoting American investment in Kenya, and also promoting security cooperation between the two countries. So that looks like, and the other one that I think may also show up is the issue of direct flights between Kenya and the U.S. There have been a number of false starts in that regard, but the airport in Nairobi has recently been upgraded, the major airport, Jomo Kenyatta International Airport, and it looks like everything may be set for the direct flights between the U.S. and Kenya to promote trade and a number of other things. So those are some of the issues.
Right, but wasn't there a major fire at that airport? So I take it it's been rebuilt, right?
Yeah, ironically, the fire occurred when the airport was being rebuilt. And since then, the new terminal has been opened. And some of the shortcomings that even led to the fire seem to have been addressed. I've actually flown through the airport twice recently. So it looks like it's a pretty good facility.
So CNN, who managed to offend Kenyans with their reporting, they've had a reporter spending some time with Barack Obama's sister, Alma. She runs a school, I take it, in the West. And there's no indication that he's going to go out there, is there, to visit her?
No, he doesn't. At least the official reports are that he's not going to be able to make it. And it's not just the family. It looks like the entire Luo Nyanza region was hoping that the president would make it that far west. But it looks like they may have to be disappointed. And I think part of it, obviously, probably is logistical issues and some other concerns.
So what is the understanding then of I mean, was Obama's book about his father, did it sell well in Kenya? I mean, it was, a very powerful and rather moving book. Are people aware of the family history of the father?
Most people here do, and I'm not really sure how well the book sold, but it has been extensively serialized in some of the local newspapers, and even if people did not get a chance to read it, they have certainly had a chance to read some excerpts that have been run in the local newspapers. And you know, the family has a complicated history. It's a very large family, and pretty much you keep seeing some new tidbits of information coming out, more so leading up to the visit by the president. And sometimes it's a little bit difficult to tell what is true and what is hype, you know.
Right. But I think in broad strokes, it's a very tragic story, isn't it? Obama's father was a young man on the rise. He got a scholarship to go to the United States, a Fulbright. He was seen, I think, as a possible rising star in the ruling political party. And then I believe he witnessed a murder or a crime and then was sort of basically told to, you know, not to say anything about it. But he decided to testify. And then the very party that had invited him in to be a part of the establishment then threatened him. And he spent the last few years of his life looking over his shoulder, afraid of his own shadow. That's my understanding from reading the book.
Yeah, and I think part of it is that he was also a fairly outspoken guy. I mean, as you probably know, he was a fairly bright individual. And in those days, that was not particularly widespread due to the ruling regime. And as you probably might also know, he was, quote-unquote, from the wrong ethnic community. So, yeah, I think he got caught up in the independence and early post-independence politics of the country that basically ended up involving largely the two major ethnic groups in the country that have dominated Kenyan politics, the Luo and the Kikuyu. So I'm sure that if he had come from the ruling group at the time, his story would have ended very differently. And who knows whether, in fact, it could have necessarily ended with Obama coming, you know, because some of these things, sometimes you really never know how they would have turned out.
Right. Well, I think he was he finally run down on the side of the road? I mean, they tried to sort of discredit him as a drunk, but he was really a man who was basically in fear of his life for the last decade of his life, my understanding.
Yeah, he did end up having quite a bit of professional frustration, you know, having a PhD from Harvard and not being able to get a job, you know, wasn't particularly a good outcome for him, and having difficulty fending for his family. From what I've read, he ended up, dying in a road accident, but I've never really been sure what the circumstances were surrounding the accident.
Right. Well, obviously, you know, the son's story is a pretty extraordinary one. I mean, and that's what everybody, I take it, is celebrating in Kenya, right?
Yeah, that's what everybody is celebrating. And actually, quite frankly, what it has done is to, in some ways, help the, as I mentioned earlier on, the two major groups that have dominated Kenyan politics have been the Luo and the Kikuyu, and the Kikuyu have been able to basically, run the country, producing three presidents, and the Luo are yet to produce one. But the joke locally here is that, you know, maybe we didn't get the presidency of Kenya, but we have ended up getting the presidency of the U.S. So it's something to smile about. And as probably you might know, Lupita Nyong'o is also from, has an ancestry in that community. So the rumor is that, you know, the other group might dominate national affairs, but will dominate international affairs, you know.
Right. And you're referring to the gorgeous Academy Award winning actress. Exactly. So in terms of the celebrations around this trip, and we mentioned what the local press is talking about now, but what about questions that are coming up? That some commentators in Kenya are saying that George W. Bush did more for Africa than Obama did, and now it's Obama's chance to redeem himself. In terms of just a personality aside, in terms of politics and in terms of U.S. engagement with Africa, what's the report card on Obama and his administration?
I've actually seen quite a bit of criticism that he didn't do as much as people were expecting. But then again, you start wondering if the expectations were perhaps misplaced. But when people compare him to former President George Bush, I think what they're specifically referring to is the amount of work he did in terms of controlling HIV/AIDS, the PEPFAR program that the U.S. Created. That has been a major success. Obama hasn't really quite had anything that was nearly as spectacular. But I think he has, in some ways, also ended up being quite inspirational, particularly to young people. So Bush may have the PEPFAR program, but I think in the long term, Obama is also going to have a significant impact in terms of being able to inspire young people in particular. But as you know, some of these things like inspiration are sometimes difficult to quantify, but there's a palpable sense that he has actually achieved quite a bit in his own right, particularly in terms of inspiring young people. But then there is also the business side, and you know, he's here for an entrepreneurship summit, and perhaps it may also end up being quite influential and impactful on his legacy on U.S. policy in Africa.
So tell us about the Entrepreneur Summit. Who's going to be there? And you know, an entrepreneur's main job, if they got a good idea, their main job is to find the capital, right? I mean, venture capital. that's what it's all about. So how do you put those two things together?
From what I've been able to see, I don't have a full list of who is going to be there, but I've seen, you know, like the founder of the Virgin Group of companies from the UK and a number of other big investors that have been in the country over the last few weeks. But there's also going to be, on the other side, young people that are trying to make it big in business. So I really think what they're trying to do is to promote business in developing the African continent, basically moving away from handouts, basically to creating opportunity. And ironically, I've been involved in working on a number of things to do with youth unemployment, and entrepreneurship has become one of the big, you know, activities that our people are pushing as a solution to that problem.
Well, you mentioned earlier that in many ways the U.S. is trying, or U.S. business people and investors are trying to play catch up to the Chinese. And that may have been more in reference to Ethiopia, which is the next leg of Obama's trip. But what's your understanding? Is there any sense that the Chinese are snapping up everything they can get their hands on?
They have actually shaken up the landscape quite a bit. That part of it is difficult to deny, particularly in sectors like infrastructure. But I've also seen Western powers recently spinning it in terms of, hey, you know, we welcome Chinese involvement. And one can even argue that the Chinese involvement in the infrastructure sector has actually created opportunities for Western corporations, creating the roads and the power that actually Western corporations might very well be able to take advantage of. So, but there is no denying that actually the Chinese have really shaken up things quite a bit.
Well, I thank you for giving us a portrait of Kenya anxiously and excitedly awaiting the arrival of their favorite son, America's President Barack Obama. I thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kefa Otiso, who's a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the U.S.-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association, and he joined us from Nairobi, Kenya. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to Beirut, Lebanon, to speak with a political analyst and commentator on Middle East geopolitics. Thank you.
القلم اكتب وخطب القلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني.
And joining us now from Beirut, Lebanon, is Shamin Nawani, who's a political analyst and commentator on Middle East geopolitics and a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College at Oxford University. She blogs at MiddleEastShuffle.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shamin Nawani.
Thank you, Ian. I'm glad to be here again.
Well, I'm grateful to have you. And just a couple of things. I wanted to get a general impression of how your region, which is obviously you're right next door to a war in Syria, is looking at events. In particular, today, Secretary of State John Kerry was grilled by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by Senator Bob Corker, who has been fairly reasonable up until now, given the antics of Senator Cotton sending a letter to the Iranian leaders and all that sort of interference, including Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel's visit. But Corker came out of the gate pretty skeptical, and if not a little bit insulting to John Kerry, and basically said, you've been fleeced. You know, this is a bad deal. You've made a bad deal. You've been fleeced. So not an auspicious beginning of a dialogue over the value of the P5+1 deal with Iran.
Well, you know, one of the things I said about a year ago when Iran deal started moving forward was that we would know if the Americans intended to pursue the deal in earnest if we saw a change in the narrative. And I think this is where the Obama administration has really fallen short. It's incumbent upon government when making a substantial policy change to sort of lay the foundations for whatever new reality and objectives they're trying to attain. And I don't think, you know, except for a few nice pieces in the media, the mainstream media about, you know, art in Iran and human interest stories here and there, we haven't seen a substantial shift. Iran has still largely been vilified, and the Iran deal has been held a little bit separately from that by Western journals. But other than that, there hasn't been a significant change, and it's what's led to the situation, the standoff in the U.S. Congress today. So, you know, I think Obama and Kerry have failed in making their case so that they would have a smooth sailing post-deal environment. And so today's hearing was, I think, proof of that. This will continue until the administration steps up and articulates their case and doesn't flip-flop, doesn't make contradictory statements, doesn't sound weak, but sounds determined and ready to fight this to the end. And we're just not seeing that from them quite yet, as opposed to how the Americans are dealing with it. The Iranians have managed expectations on the deal negotiations throughout the talks. Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, stepped in from the beginning and said, look, I don't think this deal is going to happen given the irrationality of some of our partners and their willingness to continue sabotaging us along the way. However, I'm going to put my weight behind the negotiating team, albeit draw some red lines to make sure that we don't cross over issues that can impact our national security, and manage these expectations throughout the course of the talks. I don't think we've seen the Americans stand up and do the same.
Well, you know, you'd make that criticism, Shamin, of President Obama with his signature achievement, the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare. It was never very well sold or barely sold at all, and it had a tremendous political battle, which was only decided twice by the Supreme Court. And some people who follow the White House suggest that this has a lot to do with Obama's personality, that he's, you know, a very intellectual person who sort of has contempt for the sort of posturing, brain-dead Republicans of the ilk that Dean Acheson used to call the primitives, you know, the isolationists like Tom Cotton and others and the Tea Party people. So it may be that's a problem, that they simply find it so irksome to have to deal with these people, but welcome to politics, you know.
Yeah. No, I agree with you there. I think it's possible that he's just not capable of doing that, you know, Mr. Middle, right? But he hasn't had much difficulty in vilifying Iran and going full force on that, you know. So he just needed to counter it somehow and set the scene, and he hasn't. So, of course, he's going to have a trouble selling it to the general public and to Congress. But we'll see what happens next, because, you know, there will probably be a battle within Iran as well. But I think it'll be easier sold there.
Right. Well, you know, Senator Barbara Boxer, a Democrat from California, came to Secretary Kerry's defense saying that her Republican colleagues had been disrespectful and insulting. And, you know, Kerry did actually, he was pretty forceful. But at the end of the day, everybody talks about the calculus in terms of the inevitability that the Senate will vote down the treaty in 60 days' time, and that it's all an issue of how many Democrats can be peeled off by the Republicans and by AIPAC, the Israel lobby, and I guess by extension Netanyahu, to sustain the veto. And at this point, I guess the White House figures they've got enough votes to sustain a veto, but 60 days is a long time.
It is, and I think we were hearing, I was in Vienna while the negotiations were ongoing up until the last week, and there was a lot of talk about the necessity to meet the deadline, the initial deadline, so that, you would only have 30 days and not the 60 days.
Right.
The White House had confidence if it was only the first 30 days, they'd be able to maintain the numbers they needed. So, you know, we'll wait and see. But I think from the Iranian perspective, this is an American problem, and this administration needs to take care of its own and decide, you know, how very much they want this legacy. So, you know, because there's been skepticism on behalf of the Iranian establishment or from this Iranian establishment from the start about how determined the Americans really were to pursue this this course, they've sort of factored in the fact that this could fall apart. And of course, now we're hearing the White House saying, "Look, if you don't sign on to this, if you don't back us on this, meaning Congress, the sanctions regime that we've spent years setting up is going to fall apart. Nobody's going to take us seriously, and we'll be laughingstocks." And I think that's the case, as you see. European partners or European allies are rushing to Iran, the new gold rush, to help boost their economies and their bottom lines, and trade in energy resources again. So it's going to be hard to peel them back from that course. And the entire, I think, underlying policy of the United States toward Iran will fail either way. So, you know, like I said, as the Iranians think, largely this is an American problem, and they'll be watching to see what happens.
And again, I'm speaking with Shamin Nawani, who is in Beirut, Lebanon. She's a political analyst and commentator on Mideast geopolitics and a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College at Oxford University, and she blogs at MideastShuffle.com. So the other big story is the fact that Turkey has long resisted the U.S. use of the NATO airbase at Incirlik, which would make it a lot easier for the U.S. Air Force and Navy to bomb the Islamic State, both in Syria and in Iraq. And I take it as a result of the terrorist bombing inside Turkey near the Syrian border, a deal was agreed to between President Obama and President Erdogan to allow the U.S. to use the Incirlik airbase. And that seems like a fairly big deal. And is there a sense that things are going to be changing next door in terms of the, you know, the array of forces? It's a very confusing situation, obviously. The U.S. is, in effect, allied with Iran in Iraq, fighting the self-declared Islamic State. But in Syria, they're bombing the Islamic State and, in effect, helping Iran's ally, the Assad's.
It's a very good question, and I'm afraid the answer might be even more convoluted and confusing than the question, because there are so many forces lined up here, all with competing interests. The Mesh and likely partners head in one direction. A week later, that reality changes, and there's a new direction. So I think, you know, what I'm seeing in media reports and on social media is that same kind of confusion. You know, what just happened in Turkey, and who instigated it, and who benefits from it? So we had this, as you said, terrorist bombing. Dozens of people were killed and injured, and the targets were mostly Kurds of Turkish citizenship. And I think almost right away, members of the PKK, which is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is had an uneasy truce with Turkey over the last few years, went out and killed two police officers, Turkish police officers, who they claim were collaborating with ISIS. So the Kurds think that this is an operation meant to weaken them, a Turkish intel-backed operation meant to weaken them. On the other hand, why did ISIS do this? Well, the Kurds are saying, the PKK is saying that, you know, ISIS colludes with Turkey. They have all along, and it's become fairly obvious to any observers that this is the case. And it's even more proof that this was a Turkish operation against Kurdish aspirations. But ISIS now, given the Iran deal, given the fact that it now looks like Saudi Arabia and Jordan may be next military theater in which they kick off, understand that there are different forces aligning against them in the region, and you know, they want to maybe punish the Kurds for their successes against ISIS in the northern Syrian theater, and maybe want to redirect some of the conflict into Turkey, play the Kurds against the Turks, ensure that the Turks turn on the Kurds, because now we can see that Kurds are killing Turkish security forces, or you know, the two that I mentioned, and create a conflagration there, which eases up the pressure on them in northern Syria. It could also be an ISIS warning to Kurds. It could be redirecting Kurdish fighters to Turkey from the Syrian theater, and you know, to confuse things even more, there's now this Russian initiative to bring together Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Syria to collaborate in a coalition to fight ISIS, which has not been done before. So, on the other hand, all these events could actually finally trigger Turkey to do what it should have done from the start, which is close down that border and treat ISIS as an enemy, an adversary, an enemy combatant, instead of allowing them to transit the border with weapons and financing and fighters, as they have for the last few years. And this could be, you know, this could be when, as you mentioned, the opening, the allowing the U.S. forces and the U.S.-led coalition to now access and conduct flights from the Turkish air base could be a new development. But, you know, what's exactly happened, what's triggered these things is not yet clear. I think we need a few days to digest and analyze and to see how things develop. Because there are a lot of parties with a lot of interests, a lot of paranoia, who are reacting very quickly to events. So we need to take a step back and see how these things transpire to understand if this is a new stage or if it was just one of the many incidents that kick off and then are meaningless ultimately.
Well, of course, what the trap that we might be falling into is applying kind of rational standards to an organization that may not be entirely rational, the Daesh, the Islamic State, although they've been pretty effective. And your point is well taken, that the only people in terms of boots on the ground that have taken them on effectively have been the Kurds, so they have every reason to go after the Kurds. But the Islamic State did get into a firefight on the border with Turkey and Syria up against the Turkish army. The Turkish army tanks were involved in the shootout. A Turkish soldier was killed and a couple were wounded. So that seems to be, you know, a real, if they don't want to pick a fight with Turkey, they're not going about it in the right way.
No, I mean, you're right about that. But I think, you know, the other thing that makes this all the more confusing is that within each of these organizations or governments, you know, they're not uniform in their thinking. So the Turkish military came out and said, you know, the measure we're going to take is to shut down the border, put up more barbed wire, create these spaces in a way they hadn't before. And that preempted maybe the Erdogan government, Davutoglu and Erdogan government, from perhaps doing what people have feared all along, which is creating a no-fly zone and safe zones in Syrian territory. So, you know, and ISIS, too, isn't necessary, like al-Qaeda, uniform in its thinking. You know, the central leadership may think quite differently than the rank and file that joined them from around the world. You know, some fighting for injustice against the imperialist West, or others fighting the injustice as they perceive it caused by infidels, Muslim infidels. So we can't anticipate exactly why. I think ISIS has shown some efficiency, and frankly, if they're trying to take the pressure off themselves by pitting Turks against Kurds, that's not an irrational strategy, you know. But we don't know if that is, in fact, the motivation behind this. If it was, it would be a very clever one, because as you can see by the clashes on Turkish streets, PKK picking up arms against and hitting out Turkish security forces, that it's had an immediate reaction or result.
Exactly, and that's opening a wound that's been there for a long time. Well, I thank you. I know we barely scratched the surface, and we'll have to talk again. But I thank you so much for joining us, Shamin Nawani.
It's my pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Shamin Nawani, who is in Beirut, Lebanon. She's a political analyst and commentator on Mideast geopolitics and a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College at Oxford University. And she blogs at MideastShuffle.com. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into whether Turkey's decision to allow the U.S. to use the Incirlik NATO airbase to strike the Islamic State is a game changer. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring: A New Map for the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And big developments today between U.S. and Turkey in particular. There's been a long effort on the part of the United States to get Turkey to change its mind about the U.S. being able to use the big NATO base at Incirlik. And apparently, as a result of a phone conversation between President Obama and Turkish President Erdogan on Wednesday, Turkey has agreed to let the U.S. military use this key airbase, which is near Syria, to launch airstrikes against the Islamic State. So How does this strike you? I know we've talked about this in the past, being a real bone of contention between the two countries, and you thought, I remember you saying that if Turkey gave the U.S. permission to use Incirlik, that would be a game changer.
So it is a game changer. Tactically, it allows coalition warplanes to strike Islamic State forces much more quickly and efficiently. Incirlik is only 100 miles from the Syrian border. What remains to be seen is whether the decision actually represents a shift in policy by Turkey, whether it's joining the battle against the Islamic State or it's going to continue to sit on the fence. Since 2013, President Erdogan and Turkey has been aiding and abetting the Islamic State, trying to establish it as a fighting force to depose Bashar al-Assad. This is a game changer if Turkey has finally come to its senses and made the strategic choice to join the U.S. and other NATO countries in trying to defeat the IS.
Well, if Turkey hasn't joined the fight, it looks as if the Islamic State has joined the fight against them. With the bombing that killed 32 mostly young Kurdish socialist students recently in Suruk near the border, and then just on Thursday, there was the Islamic State attacked a Turkish military border post, killing one Turkish soldier and injuring two, and prompting the Turks to retaliate with tank fire. It's difficult for me to understand what the motives for the Islamic State would be in attacking the Turkish military, but that's what they've done.
You're right. Those are two very important steps that were taken by the Islamic State. They were in response to Turkey's decision to make the border between Turkey and Syria more difficult to cross and the arrest of some Islamic State organizers in Turkey. The Islamic State was created by radical Sunnis, including sponsors in Turkey. Erdogan thought he could control the Islamic State and it would ultimately do his bidding. Now there's been a major wake-up call, and Turkey is finally coming to its senses and recognizing that its primary adversary is not the Kurds. Its primary adversary is the Islamic State, and it has to get with the program and join the U.S. and the multinational coalition in helping to defeat and degrade these forces.
But has Turkey, for a while there, it looked as if what the Islamic State was doing was trying to divide, actually provoke the Turks and the Kurds, in particularly the PKK, have had a long battle with the Turks to sort of turn them against each other. Because my understanding is the only military force on the ground that's done any damage to the Islamic State so far is the Kurds fighting in Kobani and also in Iraq. And they obviously have a grudge against them. But I thought there was a strategy, or some people thought there was actually a strategy, to try and provoke, you know, a clash between Turkey and the Kurds. So was that a strategy on the part of the Islamic State that failed?
Erdogan adopted a strategy that failed. He equated the Kurds in Syria, the People's Protection Forces, with the Islamic State, calling them both terrorist organizations. Meanwhile, the People's Protection Forces were in Kobani fighting street to street to defend the city against IS invaders. The U.S. initially said, it's not a strategic place, we're not going to be involved, but it became a poster child, a symbol for the resistance against the IS. And while Turkey sat on its hands and did nothing, the U.S. decided that it had to intervene. We notified Erdogan that we were going to be launching airstrikes. We're going to be airlifting weapons to the PKK and the PYD fighters, the Syrian Kurds, on the ground. Turkey was incensed, but the Obama administration did the right thing at the 11th hour to save Kobani. There's been a shift in the U.S. relationship with Turkey over these months as we've watched Turkey's loyalty and assistance to the Islamic State. We've tried to put a lot of pressure on them to change that approach. It looks as though General Allen's visit there last week persuaded Turkey to join the battle with the multinational coalition. So let's hope that Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party is coming to its senses. Surely the election results on June 7th sent a message to Erdogan. Voters didn't like his foreign policy. He lost 10% of the vote. So Erdogan himself is getting a wake-up call. The U.S. is echoing that with demands for closer security cooperation.
So, again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. But in terms of reigniting military or guerrilla activities between the Turkish state and the PKK, the PKK did kill a couple of Turkish policemen who they accused of working with the Islamic State. We know there is a fairly sophisticated underground railroad that has been put together, obviously, by Turks sympathetic to the Islamic State, because these fighters coming from Europe, when they get to Istanbul, they are met by people who give them safe houses and safe passage all the way across Turkey into Syria. And that's been going on for some time.
Yes, it's called the Jihadi Highway.
So what's that about? And I believe the PKK also killed somebody that they said was an Islamic State terrorist in Istanbul. So explain what's going on there, if you will.
The Kurds are proving to be America's best allies in the region. And even though the PKK is on the U.S. list of foreign terrorist organizations, we've been working with them. We've been providing them weapons, and we've been providing them with air power and air support. Right now, the Syrian Kurds control 75% of the border between Turkey and Syria. Turkey has been demanding that the U.S. establish a no-fly zone and a buffer zone along the border. It's threatened to go into those Kurdish territories called Rojava and establish the buffer zone itself. The U.S. has dissuaded them from doing that. Meanwhile, you know, we've gone to war with the Syrian Kurds, who have shown the capability to defeat ISIS in Syria. We're also working hand in glove with the Peshmerga, with the Kurds in Iraqi Kurdistan. And increasingly, you know, there's a realization in Washington, I was there yesterday and had senior meetings, that Iraq is a failed state, that it's fragmenting, that the Baghdad First policy isn't working, and that Iraqi Kurdistan is going to become independent. So Erdogan is starting to take a measure of reality. There's going to be an independent Iraqi Kurdistan on one of his borders. There's already this autonomous Kurdish statelet called Rojava on the Syrian border, which provides self-government and self-security. So Turkey's strategic interests are seriously affected. The decision to join the U.S. in the battle against the Islamic State is recognition that Turkey needs friends and allies, that it's made a mistake by distancing itself from NATO and the U.S., and it's trying to get back in the tent. Let's see if that's a sustained effort and if Turkey can really be counted upon.
But when you say Turkey has finally started to recognize reality with the fragmentation of Iraq, the U.S. doesn't seem to have recognized reality. We're still dealing with this bogus government there in the green zone, as though Abadi is actually the real leader, and the criminal kleptocrat that we've supported before him is not actually pulling the strings.
So that's absolutely right. You know, our stated policy is that all military assistance goes by, with, and through Baghdad. But there's a difference, Ian, between our stated policy and reality, which is becoming increasingly apparent to U.S. officials. You know, we've been interacting extensively with officials in the executive branch, and I sense an awareness on their part that Iraq is finished, that Iraqi Kurdistan is going to emerge as a sovereign state, that the Kurds are our best ally in the fight against ISIS, and our top priority is counterterrorism. So we're looking for some greater balance. We want Erdogan on board with our efforts. Let's see if the decision to allow coalition warplanes to use in Çığlık is part of a broader effort by Turkey and the United States to work together in the security and diplomatic fields to address the Islamic State threat and to confront realities, which is a shifting map of the Middle East.
So if we do finally accept the reality that Iraq is no longer a state and that it's already split into Shiistan, Jihadistan, the Sunni area, Anbar, and the Kurdish state, obviously, the Iranians are not very happy about it. I mean, the main concern has been Turkey's reaction to that. And if indeed Turkey is starting to consider, you know, try to live with this idea, we'll see about that. But it still remains that Iran's not happy about it, even though Iran will end up basically influencing, if not controlling, the Shia oil-rich part of Iraq.
So, yeah, you're right about that. There are 10 million Kurds in Iran, in Iranian Kurdistan and Kermanshah, and they're starting to clamor for greater rights. They want a federal constitution along the lines of the 2005 constitution that was intended to decentralize power from Baghdad to the regions. Last month, there was a major riot in Mahabad, and 30 Kurds were killed and another 70 were injured. So Iran has a major problem on its hands in Iranian Kurdistan. But it's not only the Kurds that are demanding more rights. 40% of Iran's population are ethnic minorities, including Azeris. What remains to be seen about the Iranian nuclear deal is whether or not that's going to start to liberalize and open up society. Iraqi Kurdistan is located in a rough neighborhood. It has contentious relations with Baghdad, with Iran, and with Turkey. But all of those relations are built on rational actors who understand that they have an interest in cooperation, that there's oil export, that there's financial benefits to working across the border. So as Iraqi Kurdistan moves towards independence, and we might see a more reality-based approach, not only in Washington, but also in Ankara and in Tehran.
But it is a landlocked country and will be a country soon by the sound of it. It's a de facto a country at any rate. It has to have good relations with Turkey, doesn't it, to be viable?
It's had a strategic partnership with Turkey. Right now there are 500,000 barrels of oil a day that are being transported from Iraqi Kurdistan to the Turkish Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. In the past, there have been billions of dollars worth of construction and trade business between Turkey and Iraqi Kurdistan. With Iraq increasingly Islamicized and the Islamic State problem now knocking on Turkey's door, they might find that there are security benefits to working more closely with the Kurds. First in Iraqi Kurdistan, but also trying to find some peace with the Kurds in Syria, and fully and finally addressing the demands of Kurds in Turkey for greater democratic and cultural rights. The U.S. is the only country that has the leverage to work on Kurdish issues and fighting the Islamic State in the region. You know, it's time that we use our influence and started brokering deals that create stable allies and friendly regimes that will join us in the fight against terrorism.
Well, it sounds like already the Kurds, you know, who've had this, at least the PKK, have had this long guerrilla war against the Turkish state, and the Turkish state's been really obdurate and stubborn in not recognizing them and they're not recognizing their language. I don't think they even use the word Kurd. They used to refer to them as Mountain Turks. That appears to be changing because the Kurds entered into that coalition in that last election that did very well, did it not?
The Kurdish party surpassed the barrier of 10%, now has 80 seats in the parliament. Erdogan wants support in the parliament to create an executive presidency. He's not going to get it with Kurds controlling that kind of a minority. It's time for Turkey to establish a new coalition government, for the coalition government to be inclusive and more democratic. The Kurds in Turkey are not looking for an independent state. This idea of a greater Kurdistan was floated in the 1980s. It never had much traction. All they want are more democratic and cultural rights, which are aligned with European standards. That's what Turks want as well. it's precisely because of Erdogan's adventurism in Syria, his support for the Islamic State, the arrival of 2 million Syrian refugees on Turkish soil, that Turks have said, we've had enough. You know, we want there to be peace at home and peace abroad, which was Atatürk's famous slogan. You know, Erdogan now has the responsibility to deliver. If he doesn't, he's going to continue to lose favor. The decision to allow Incirlik Air Force Base as a staging ground for coalition warplanes is a big step in the right direction.
Coalition warplanes and drones.
And drones, you know, that we've been using in Incirlik for some humanitarian operations, but now it's a staging ground for striking and killing Islamic State fighters. That kind of cooperation is long overdue.
Well, but what's it going to do, though, to change the facts on the ground in Syria? Because we have this inherent contradiction where in Iraq we're essentially allied with Iran against the Islamic State, whereas in Syria next door, we're bombing the Islamic State, in doing so, helping Iran's ally, the Assad regime.
There's a saying in the Middle East that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. In no case is that more apparent than these shifting alliances. Allowing Incirlik to be used as a staging ground is no panacea for defeating the Islamic State. It does establish the basis for closer cooperation between the U.S., Turkey, and others fighting the IS, namely the Kurds. The United States needs to broker that cooperation to move Turkey closer to an agreement with the PKK that would establish fuller rights for Kurds in Turkey. And this ongoing dispute between Turkey and the Syrian Kurds needs to be set aside. Essentially, we all now are on the same side of the tennis court. We're all fighting the Islamic State. The IS brought the battle to Turkey, and they have no choice now but to join and to form more strategic alliances with other groups, the Kurds in Iraq and the Kurds in Syria, who are also combating the Islamic State fighters.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and is the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He is a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and his latest book just out is The Kurdish Spring: A New Map for the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.